beautiful people, and welcome back to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. I am your host, Natalie K. Douglas, and today we have such an epic interview with the lovely Dr. Tash. Now, before I give you a bit of a background on Dr. Tash, I wanted to remind you that we have just opened up the doors for the last round of Thyroid Rescue for 2020. So for those of you who don't know what Thyroid Rescue is, it is a 10-week online thyroid healing and energy transformation program designed to help those of you who have an underactive thyroid or Hashimoto's or the symptoms of an underactive thyroid completely turn your energy, your thyroid health, your gut health, your hormone health, and all of the healths around. I'm just kidding, kind of. And it is something that I am so excited to bring to you because the last round that we had was such a pleasure to run. We had so many amazing, amazing, amazing results, and it really just continues to remind me the power of, you know, natural medicine, of holistic healing, of going through a healing journey with support, not just from a practitioner, but also support from a community of people who actually get it, you know. So you can check out the information around Thyroid Rescue Plus and Thyroid Rescue Basic, which are the two versions of the Thyroid Rescue program, over on my website by heading to the Thyroid Rescue tab. So Natalie K. Douglas / Thyroid Rescue. And you can also jump over onto my Instagram page because there's loads of information there, and I will be hanging out there for the next few days and into next week as well, sharing about the program and sharing some really interesting info on thyroid health. Now, just a reminder that spots are limited to Thyroid Rescue. So Thyroid Rescue Plus, there is only 10 spots available, three of which have already been taken up in the first hour of opening the doors. And Thyroid Rescue Basic, we have 20 spots available, and a few of those have already been snapped up too. So make sure you don't sit on the fence for too long because they will get taken up, and I won't be running any more rounds of Thyroid Rescue until 2021, and it is currently the only way I work with clients who have an underactive thyroid. So without further ado, before we jump into the interview, I would really like to give you a bit of a background on Dr. Natasha Andriadis, or as we all know her, Dr. Tash, or the Fanny Mechanic. So Dr. Tash is a qualified and experienced gynecologist, fertility and hormone specialist. She is a certified reproductive endocrinologist and infertility subspecialist, making her uniquely qualified to manage infertility and hormonal issues. She believes in a holistic and integrative approach to health, and she has a particular interest in the impact of nutrition, lifestyle, and environment on reproductive health. She wants people to lead healthy lives and have healthy babies. Dr. Tash is also incredibly qualified, and I'm not going to run through every qualification and award she's been given because we would probably be here for a little while. I do want to share with you, though, that she actually is the host of the women's health podcast called The Fanny Mechanic, and she runs a monthly book club called the Dr. Tash Book Club. She loves to give her patients a look at the latest evidence with her informative and entertaining video blogs. She loves running and working with female athletes and coaches on menstrual cycle education, and she's worked with Fitbit and Modibody consulting on women's health. Her current research interest is music therapy and its role in managing stress and anxiety related to gynecological and fertility treatments. So you can check Tash out over on Instagram, on her podcast, and I will pop all of those links in the show notes. So jump on over there after you listen to the show and give Tash a follow. Definitely listen to her podcast. It is incredibly interesting, and she is just a wealth of information and one of the most curious, open-minded, beautiful practitioners that I have met. So let's jump in and get started. Dr. Tash, the fanny mechanic, welcome to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And can I just say, total respect for that name. You know what? My husband originally wanted or suggested that Kate and I call our podcast the Lady Gardener Podcast.
You could do a name change, you know.
Oh, I could, although I don't know who would click on that. the wrong people.
Yeah, I say give it a go and see how you go.
Bit of market research.
Yeah, that's right.
Love it. Well, I think I'd love to jump straight into the topic for today. But before I do, I love to get to know a little bit about you, or for everyone listening to get to know you. And the thing I love to ask people is, what is your current morning routine? I know that you're a busy person, so I'm really interested in this.
I usually just wake up and ask myself what I want to do. I don't really have a routine in the morning. I have a routine more in the evening. But my routine in the morning is I wake up and I assess how I feel. Mm-hmm. And one thing I know is that when I start my day, I want it to start slowly. I don't like being rushed, and I like to be able to take things really easy in the morning. So that's my main objective in the morning, not to stress myself out, to relax into the day. That's pretty much it. I don't really have any. I do X, Y, Zs. I just wake up and ask myself literally that. What are you in the mood for? Do you want to go for a walk? Do you want to stay and just, you know, drink a coffee really slowly, read a book? What do you feel like doing? So that's how I start my day.
I love it. I like that. I think more of us should probably check in with ourselves early in the day, right? It's one of those things that is a bit foreign. Most people just wake up to an alarm and off they go, rushed into the day. So like it.
Thank you.
So today we're chatting all about kind of IVF and assisted reproductive technologies, because I feel like this is an area where a lot of people have no idea about it until it's happening to them. And then it feels like what I can imagine is information overload. So where I'd like to start is just with explaining to people what the main types of assisted reproductive technologies are available in Australia, and maybe just a couple, like the difference between some of the main ones.
Yeah, I mean, this is quite a big topic, because assisted reproduction can be as simple as you're not ovulating, I need to give you medication to assist you to ovulate, and in doing that, I need to monitor your ovulation, and I need to do blood tests and ultrasounds to assess that. And then you can go one up more from that, which is we would do intrauterine insemination. So if there's a male issue, or if the couple's not having sex or whatever, we would intervene further by doing intrauterine insemination, which is injecting sperm into the uterus. Then further from that, you've got injection. So we could inject, or a woman can inject herself with drugs, follicle stimulating hormone, generally speaking. However, if she's not ovulating regularly because she's hypothalamic or overexercising, we may need to combine that with some LH. So assisted reproduction is a huge topic, actually. So it can start as simple as that, because that for me is the simplest example of ART, or assisted reproductive technologies. And then you can go to the average couple, which is, you know, someone who comes and sees me that is a heterosexual couple, and we'll talk about homosexual couples and the LGBTIQ community in a bit. But pretty much, you know, you'll have a couple who come to see you, they've been trying for 12 months, no obvious causes of infertility, and one of their options is to go to ART, the ultimate in ART, which I feel is IVF treatment. And a lot of people hesitate about going to IVF, in vitro fertilization, but I see there is lots of benefit to it, because when we're doing IVF, we're stimulating woman's ovaries, we're collecting her eggs, we then get sperm from the partner, generally speaking. There are, you know, variations to that. We'll talk about those later. Mm-hmm. But pretty much you're looking at the gametes, so the eggs and the sperm in the lab, and you're putting them together to see how they would develop into embryos. And when you get to that point, it's very easy to see why some couples are not conceiving, because their embryo quality is really quite poor. Mm-hmm. And you don't know always how to make sense of that, but all you can say to them is, look, listen, the reason why you're not conceiving is because your embryo quality is really poor, or the egg quality is really poor, or the sperm is poor. So it's also a diagnostic, not just diagnostic, it's therapeutic. So once IVF can do two things, which is pretty amazing as far as medicine, I feel, is concerned. So, you know, that's your kind of typical inverted commas case. But then ART also covers, say, single women coming to see me for egg freezing, or a woman who is, you know, has got breast cancer and she realizes, oh, God, you know, chemo radiotherapy is going to kill my ovaries. I pretty much need to have some form of assisted reproduction, i.e. egg freezing, to preserve my fertility. So, you know, egg preservation is a big part of that. And then you have either one of those women may come and see you later on to have those eggs used. And in doing that, we thaw their eggs. And we then have to generally inject those eggs with sperm to enable embryos to develop, whether that be with a sperm donor or that is known or unknown to them. Then you have couples who are transitioning. So in the LGBTIQ community, you have, you know, women who are transitioning to men. And at some point they may have no ovaries left because part of their transition may involve, not always, removing their ovaries. So before they get to that point, we may need to do an egg collection on them, which is a form of assisted reproductive technology. If it's a trans woman, that is a man who's transitioning to a woman, we would need to potentially freeze his sperm. Because if we have to transition him into a woman, we need to give him estrogen, which suppresses spermatogenesis and the production of sperm. So sperm freezing itself is a form of assisted reproduction, egg donation. So we know that a lot of women are either have gone through the early menopause. You know, I saw a case of a woman yesterday who's 31 and clearly menopausal. You know, 2 years of trying with her partner. Lovely couple, and when they first got married, she just had all these symptoms of anxiety and stress, and she was from overseas, moved to Australia, and she initially thought, oh, it's just me not coping with moving to Australia. But in fact, there were so many hormonal reasons why she was feeling that way, because she was perimenopausal. So Thankfully, her partner is open to egg donation, which then lends itself to, you know, other things like surrogacy. So is there a gestational surrogate or a traditional surrogate, which we could talk about a bit later. There's embryo donation as well. There are lots of couples who are making the embryos, and we're storing a crazy amount of embryos at the moment worldwide. A lot of embryos are just sitting there doing nothing. You know, I've got one example of one patient who I treated from one ovarian stimulation cycle. She has had numerous embryos frozen. From that one cycle, she's had her third child, but she's got all these other embryos frozen. So what is she going to do with those? Is she on a yearly basis going to just pay the fees to keep them frozen? Is it ever going to cross her mind that, you know, maybe there are some patients out there or couples that would like to have my embryos? And look, we have a lot of discussion in the IVF world about the ethics around embryo donation. And you can have ethical conversations about every aspect of ART. You know, in Italy years ago, they were not freezing eggs because they just didn't believe, so not embryos, they were not freezing embryos. And that's why initially Italy was a real pioneer in egg freezing for religious reasons, really, if anything. Wow. And another example, one of my favorite couples recently got pregnant, young couple, but they decided they did not want to try naturally because he has a genetic condition. And we put them through an IVF cycle, and we embryo biopsied what they had available and only put back embryos that were not affected by the same disease that he has. And they are pregnant, which is amazing. And I love hearing, you know, those stories of positive pregnancy testing couples like that. So assisted reproductive technologies are very broad. It's not just IVF, routine IVF. You're serving under that umbrella a real broad aspect of, I feel, the community in doing that.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, isn't it? Because I think the assumption made a lot of the time is just that there's IVF until you enter into that world and you're like, actually, there are a lot of options. And I guess a couple of questions that have come up for me from that is, first of all, like, you know, in terms of trying naturally and the amount of time people should try naturally before seeking further help, is it a 12-month period? Does it change if you're older? What are your guidelines around that in terms of naturally trying to conceive? Because we know that it's not just as much as going through school. It's kind of, you think that as soon as you look at a boy, you're going to get pregnant. It's not really like that, is it? So
yeah.
What's your advice around that?
Well, you know, in some couples, I feel like it is like that, because for some people, it's so easy to get pregnant, and then they're the couples that often miscarry very quickly. So that's another spectrum. But firstly, I'd like to tell everyone that if you have a hunch about something or you don't feel that something is right, go and see your doctor. And the reason why I bring that up is because in the fertility journals and in the ART journals, there will be, if you're less than 35 and you've been trying for a year, go and see a fertility specialist then. Mm-hmm. If you're over 35 and you've been trying for 6 months and you're not pregnant, go and see a fertility specialist then. And I think there's good reason why that's been put out as a guide. However, my ideal patient and the patients that I get the most excited about seeing are those patients who haven't even tried yet and come and see me for preconception advice.
Yeah,
they come and see me because they're like, hey, Tash, we want to have a baby. We want to do this as kind of as effectively as possible. Can you give us guidance? I love patients like that. But as a fertility specialist, I don't tend to get patients like that. I tend to get patients who have been struggling according to the textbook, you know, definitions of what infertility is. So I would say to people, really be guided by your intuition too. And sometimes it's very obvious that, for example, if a man has bilateral undescended testicles, so he was born with undescended testicles and he needed to have an operation in early infancy to pull those testicles into the scrotum, he is much more likely later on in life to have issues with sperm production and to be able to conceive. So that's kind of a red flag, you know. So I think it's really important for people to have these open discussions as a couple early on, you know. When you were born, was everything okay? Did you need any surgery when you were born for anything, for whatever it was? If I've got a mother, and this is why it's important to say good family histories around the dinner table, you know, how old was your mother when she went through the menopause? Do you know how old she was? Because if your mother was 35 when she went through the menopause, then your ears really should prick up, because you're at risk then of going through the early menopause for genetic reasons, and most of the time, 50% of the time at least, there won't be a known cause. But that should also make you think, oh, wait a minute, maybe I should get my ovarian reserve test checked, the AMH or the egg timer test checked. So, yeah, that's my little spiel about when should you see a doctor.
Yeah, no, and I love that.
And I also have patients who tell me, with all respect to GPs, that I see my GP and they just were, you know, they didn't want me to go and see a gynecologist yet or a fertility specialist. They were like, no, keep trying. I'm like, no, well, actually, no. If you're insisting, you have every right as a consumer of health to see that specialist if you so choose. You know, and to the point where I've had people come to me without a referral, because they're like, well, he didn't want to give me a referral, so I just came along anyway, and I'm not going to get a rebate, but that's okay, because at least I really want to see you. So I actually think it's important to explain to people statistics around how old you are, what's your age, and what are the chances of falling pregnant. So if you're 25, your chances of getting pregnant per month are maybe 20 to 25% per month at best. And as we get older, that decreases. So also being open about expectations of what's going to happen every month. What are my chances every month?
Yeah.
If I'm in my 40s, it's not going to be 20 to 25%.
And I think that's something people like are not aware of, like how, like what the actual chances of getting pregnant are each month. I think people have a general awareness around, oh yeah, it decreases with age, but not really an awareness of, you know, month to month, like what those chances are. I wonder, like, what's your experience around how aware the patients you're seeing are about the male role in fertility? Like, is it something that you're having to give a lot of education on, or are you seeing more couples who are aware, hey, actually, like, there's a big role that males play here?
That's a very interesting question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because that brings up a lot of stuff about infertility and the very much entrenched view that it's a woman's issue, when up to 30 to 40% of the time there is a significant male factor. And often what I find in my practice is that women underplay the issues that their partners are having in the bedroom. You know, he'll have some obvious issue with his erectile dysfunction or, you know, ejaculation, but she won't bring it up too much because she's sensitive to him. And she doesn't want to make him feel bad. But let me tell you how many times I see couples and that's the only problem that comes up. Yeah, we have women who are trying to, I feel for him, you know, it's probably, you know, he's not going to cope well with the news. And they take all of that onto themselves. And in some way they will try and find a reason that it's still their fault. But I'm like, well, wait a minute. The only thing I can see here, and I have a highlighter and I highlight everything that patients write on their forms, and it's very obvious to me during a consult what the problem is. And I find that's a point that comes up again and again. So the male role plays a big role, a huge role, to the point where I won't see a couple for a fertility assessment unless he turns up.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been going down a similar path lately in terms of, you know, insisting that if they're coming to see me for fertility, even from like a nutrition perspective and supplement perspective, it's so important that, you know, the male is involved, because I just think the amount of times that I've seen sperm analysis done, because sometimes women will just send me their partner's sperm analysis and just be like, by the way, here's his. And so, like, so many poor counts, so many, like, really poor DNA fragmentation or damaged sperm. And I actually I don't know if you find this, and perhaps you don't because you're working with much more complex cases, but I find males really easy to fix if they follow the advice, because a lot of the time for the men I'm seeing, even just making changes in terms of alcohol, caffeine, not putting their bloody phones right near their balls, you know, just decreasing their toxic load generally, taking some selenium, zinc, I often see quite good changes in a 3-4 month period.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that one. And it's a lot more measurable and easy to see on a result, whereas with women it's not that easy. Yeah. And that's why – and I actually find men quite easy to work with. Like when you're able to explain the issue to them, I find men very receptive.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if it's because I just have that rapport with men, but I actually find them very easy to treat, you know, like and I always used to joke with some of my medical mates that I should have been a urologist. You know, I'm like, what am I doing being a fanny mechanic? I should be a dick doctor.
Totally.
Yeah.
I have the same experience, because you just, you know, tell them the information and explain why, and then like, okay. I say, do you have any question? Nah, all good.
Yeah.
Okay. See you soon.
And then often, you know, you'll have the female partner coming in and saying, I've got him on these supplements, I've got him on this, I've got him on that. Yeah. And I'm like, that's great. And look, I think there is a role in seeing a woman on her own, to be able to connect with her on her own before her partner comes along, because women overall are way more invested in this than men. I feel that if women didn't drive reproduction, the population of the world would be abysmal. You know, women drive this mainly more than men, I feel. And you know, it's a powerful thing. I think women have to remember that, but they also have to respect themselves enough to say, well, actually, the problem probably doesn't really lie with me. It's actually with him. That sometimes you just have to ease into that. You know, it's a bit like, you know, when you're going to the beach in Cronulla, and I'm sure you know how this happens every day, but Some days you just dip your toe into the water to assess the temperature of the water, and then you're just going to keep going into the waves. I think that's what it's like with fertility. You know, it's kind of, you're going to dip your toe into the water, and then you're going to have the courage to go deeper and deeper and go with that. So,
Yeah, I agree. And I love that analogy too. So just circling back to IVF, what I got from what you were saying in the beginning is, you know, more instead of this idea of it being, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but instead of it being this idea of you're kind of climbing this ladder of options until you get to the most assisted possible reproductive technology, do you find that you are more matching the couple in front of you and what their issues are to exactly what type of assisted reproductive technology is going to be best for them? And is it a place where when people come to you, you give them those options after assessing what's going on for them?
Yeah, look, options are everything. And I often quote one of my bosses, Wally Birrell, who when I trained at RPA, he used to say to me, it's your job as the doctor to give patients the options. It's up to them to choose what they want. And the way I see it, it's a bit like going to a restaurant and ordering something off the menu. There are clearly things that are not going to be right for me if I'm gluten-free, right? And it's up to the doctor to say, this is definitely not right for you. It's like got gluten in it, but you're gluten-free, so you can't have this, right? But there will be other things on the menu that will be suitable for that patient. And at the end of the day, it's up to the patient and their partner, or if they've not got a partner, on their own, single, even with friends or mum, they can decide what is best for them. So very much you will say, and sometimes it's very obvious what the couple needs, right? If she's had blocked fallopian tubes, bilateral ectopics, or severe endometriosis, both of her fallopian tubes removed, she needs IVF, no question. Or she adopts, or she has, egg donation or something, you know, outside of that. The good thing about assisted reproductive technology is that there are options. There are lots of options for people, generally speaking. It's a bit like menopause and treating the menopause. In the menopause, there are a huge amount of options for people. Mm. But women don't realize this. They just think they kind of put up and suffer when they shouldn't need to.
Absolutely. So in your opinion, is like, who is an ideal candidate and who is maybe not an ideal candidate for IVF in particular?
Look, I think it's easier to approach that and my answer from the isn't a good candidate, because most people are good candidates. Most people make okay candidates.
Yeah.
The candidates that people who I feel very uncomfortable about putting through IVF are smokers, for example. Because it significantly reduces the chances of it working.
Mm-hmm.
It reduces the chances of it working by half. It increases the chance of miscarriage, ectopic abnormalities in pregnancy. And even there's some evidence that if a child is born or conceived when the mother or father is smoking, particularly the father, there's an increased risk of leukemia and cancers in early childhood. Mm-hmm. So when I see couples going through IVF treatment who are still smoking, and this really happens because I'm so strict about that one, and, you know, a lot of people could lie. I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah.
They have the occasional cigarette and don't tell anyone and whatever. Mm. But at the end of the day, they know, you know, it's their action that is jeopardizing their success.
Yeah.
So the smoking really came up for me. And people who can't follow instructions, that happens rarely, but there are some, you know, women in particular when it comes to injections who just are really all over the place. But the chances of that are very small. Most women are very good at following instructions and chase, you know, doctors and nurses for their instructions. Of course, there's the woman who's too old, or the couple that's, I feel, too old. So we're talking about, you know, people in their mid-50s who come and see you who want IVF, and they are clearly unrealistic about what biology 101 is, or what that means. So, you know, I think most people are okay candidates for IVF treatment.
Yeah. And what are the actual success rates of IVF?
Yeah, I mean, that depends on the clinic. It depends on, for example, when you compare American success rates to Australian success rates, they may be higher in the US, but in the US, they tend to build back multiple embryos, where in Australia, we don't do that. I think I've only put back two embryos once in my whole professional career.
Yeah, right.
So
why is that, Tash?
Because we know that if you put back two embryos, the chances of ending up with twins or triplets, mainly triplets is the bigger concern, or quadruplets, you're more likely to end up with a pregnancy that's not going to go down a nice, clear, straightforward path. You're more likely to have babies born early, prematurely, who die, who are disabled, who have cerebral palsy. And, of course, we can't forget the mother who gets often traumatized by that whole experience. So we don't talk about birth trauma enough, but that is a very common thing that probably is not talked about often enough, really. So the healthiest way to get a baby, the I feel, is to put back one embryo at a time. And this is really honed in the UK a lot, but Australia is a champion of this. Australia is a leader in single embryo transfer and minimizing the risk of embryos splitting or quadrupling. Why? Because thankfully our government our government pretty much funds IVF really well compared to a lot of other countries. So we have a lot to be grateful for in this country. And I think we need to remember that. And you know, when people come and ask me, I'd love twins. And I always say to them, you know what? Most couples who have twins will be happy, but there will be a proportion that will not be happy at all with the outcome.
Yeah.
And I never have anyone who's had twins come back and ask for double embryo transfer or can I have twins again? Because it's harder, right?
Yeah.
I don't have children. I've not brought up a young baby, but I've been surrounded by women who have. And I could imagine that having two, it will be a lot more challenging than one, provided you can get them home in that in a healthy state, because sometimes those babies don't go home, right? They have complications and sometimes just don't come home ever. Yeah. So, yeah.
That makes sense. And I guess like another question that comes up just in terms of the embryos and transferring them, do you like routinely do testing on the embryos before implanting them, or is that something that is only recommended in certain situations or for certain couples?
Yeah, so if you've got a couple who are having recurrent pregnancy loss, so they've had three or four, you know, pregnancy losses, they're in their mid-30s, they would clearly be candidates for that when we're talking about pre-implantation genetic screening to look to see that the embryos are not affected by chromosomal issues like Down syndrome, for example, or trisomy 13, 18, whatever trisomy or other abnormalities there are. So we do this technology, we use this technology a lot. I put a lot of patients through PGS or pre-implantation genetic screening. Mm-hmm. And the premise of that is to get people pregnant quicker, because until recently we've been putting back embryos based on the way they look, their morphology, and we know that an embryo can look beautiful. It can be a star blastocyst embryo on day 5, but genetically it might be trisomy 13 or another obscure and what we call aneuploidy or abnormality in chromosomes that will never get it to even implantation, or if it does get to implantation, then miscarriage. It's commonly utilized. There is contention and there's lots of kind of papers that have been published that say maybe that women who are less than 30 certainly may never really benefit from this, because overwhelmingly if you're a 30-year-old woman, most of your embryos will be euploid, that is, they'll have a normal karyotype. However, if you're over 40, most of your embryos may be actually aneuploid, so abnormal in their chromosome makeup. So in that group, you will offer genetic testing. But I think what's important to understand is that not everyone who is keen on that type of testing will get to that testing, because it's about the embryo meeting criteria to enable it to be biopsied. So embryos have to meet certain criteria in the laboratory that will you know, kind of signal to the embryologist, the scientist who works on embryos, that this embryo here is suitable for testing. There are clearly some embryos that are not suitable for testing, and that often happens. And patients get really disappointed because they're like, oh, I really wanted embryo biopsy, but I didn't get to that. And you just have to be very clear with the patients about that scenario to manage expectation again.
Yeah, I can imagine there's a lot of that, because a lot of information coming at people, and probably a big part of your job is being really clear about what the options are and the chances. And I guess, like, it must be challenging to create the balance between being realistic and also being encouraging and hopeful, because it's, I think there's a lot to, I personally think there's a lot to belief and mindset, but then I also, I mean, even just in my like practice experience, I think there's also an importance of being realistic with someone. I find it really hard to strike that balance. How do you find that?
I think it's important to highlight the good bits, but also to talk about the realistic bits. So, you know, a good bit being maybe a woman in her 40s who's got a great AMH. I love seeing that, and I'm very optimistic when I see that. And I'll say to her, but, you know, you are 40 and the chances of us getting good quality eggs is probably lower, but at least you've got a good AMH, and we're going into this hopeful that we'll at least get some eggs that will be of good quality potentially. And I think it's also important to ask patients what they want and what their expectations are. And I often let patients guide me with what they want. So I give them the options, and at the end of the day, they usually guide me. I mean, I have had some scenarios where, and I'll give you one example. I had a patient who has got premature menopause. She's in her early 30s, and we put her through some IVF cycles, but she was just not getting many eggs coming, like follicles coming through, and I'd cancel each cycle. There was only one or two follicles coming through, and I'm like, well, are we really going to pay all this money just to get one or two eggs when we can just do IUI? You know, you are less than 35, chances are okay. And then the third or fourth cycle, I asked her, what do you want to do? I said, do you want to go for IVF or do you want to do the same? She goes, I want to do IVF this time. I'm like, okay, let's do it. I wasn't very hopeful. And I think she had three follicles. We got two eggs. One embryo developed, we put that back, she's pregnant. And, you know, I would have actually just gone cancel, just do IUI, but she wanted to go for the egg collection, which we did do, and she got pregnant. And so I think a lot of the time I sleep better knowing that at the end of the day the patient has made the decision. Because there's no right or wrong, right? There's no guidebook to tell me that she's right and that I'm wrong, or that I'm right and she's wrong in this scenario. In some scenarios it's a bit different, but you've just got to work with the patient.
I love that. What a beautiful way to approach it. And you also brought up there like AMH and amount of eggs and egg quality, and that leads me into another question I wanted to ask you, which is quality or quantity of the eggs the most important thing when it comes to IVF, or do you think they're of equal importance?
Well, that's a tricky one. I mean, this last patient I just discussed, you know, she got pregnant most likely because of the fact that she had pretty good egg quality despite having low egg reserves and a very low AMH, you know, being perimenopausal. I mean, I've had a couple's and women in their 40s who have a really good AMH. We get lots of eggs, but then you see the embryo just crumbling on the fifth day of development and or the third day. So both of those things are important.
And
they're not mutually exclusive either.
And is there, if people are doing an AMH test, is there a certain time of their cycle that they are best to do it to get more accurate results, or does it not matter?
I think early on the study showed that any time in the cycle was fine, but then I read that it's probably best to do it in the first half of your cycle.
Yeah, I read similar
things. Have you read the same thing? Yeah.
Because I, used to just say anytime, and then in since reading some of that as well, I get people to do it usually on day two or three when I'm doing on their other hormones just because it's convenient as well.
Yeah. Well, so when you do the FSH, LH, estradiol, progesterone, it's a good time to do this, the same timing for the AMH.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you've kind of said there, like quality and quantity are important. And I think even just in some of your examples with people falling pregnant with low AMH, I think taking the whole picture into consideration is so important. I see a lot of women get incredibly stressed out if they have a low AMH, even if everything else looks really good. And of course, like, you know, it counts and that's, you know, good to take into consideration. But do you find that, like, are people freaking out when they come to you if their AMH is not up to where it's supposed to be according to their age?
All the time, multiple times a week. And I lately have been pulling out a patient example, one of my favorite patients. When I say favorite, it's because she was just a really lovely person to work with. And she had just a real go-getter approach, this woman. I loved seeing her in my waiting room. And she came to see me because she was single and wanted to freeze some eggs. Prior to seeing me, she'd had 13 or 14 terminations of pregnancy. So had no problem falling pregnant. You know, mid-30s. And essentially when I did her AMH, it was less than one. It was really low. And I said to her, okay, if we're going to look at freezing eggs, we're not going to get that many. You know that. And she said, okay, let's just give it a go. So we gave it a go and I cancelled her cycle because she only had, I think, one dominant follicle. So she decided that she was going to go away and have sex with a friend, and she did, and she got pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And has a boy. And then a few years later I saw her again. She was perimenopausal, as predicted by her AMH, and came to see me. This time she had a friend in mind who wanted to act as a sperm donor, a lovely guy who I met, and he froze some sperm. He did the sperm donation thing, quarantined the sperm. And we did intrauterine insemination with her. And because I said, look, there's no point in putting you through an IVF cycle again or doing that ovarian stimulation cycle because clearly you are not going to get more than one egg. So let's just put you through IUI. So I did a stim IUI on her and she got pregnant and she's probably going to be mum soon again with her second kid. So she had a super low AMH, but she had been pregnant numerous times and chose to terminate her pregnancies and, yes, did need some assistance to actually get the children that she has now. But I always bring her up as the case about AMH because her AMH was really low. And in looking at that number, you think, what? Are you ever going to get pregnant? But she's had no problems getting pregnant.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? And it goes to show you, as with everything in health, like the whole picture matters. And I speak about that all the time, even in relation to like to anything, to gut stuff, to thyroid health, to all hormone stuff. It's like the whole picture. And the reality is we know a lot, but we certainly don't know everything. And I think that's a really good story to tell. So I know that some people listening will probably have curiosities around, well, what does an IVF cycle actually look like? So can you give us a bit of an overview around if, say, there's a couple that come in and they've agreed that they want to do IVF, what does that process actually look like? Because you've mentioned a few times doing injections and stimulation and that kind of thing. So what does the process look like?
Yeah, so I'm assuming that, you know, we've made a decision with this couple and say they've got idiopathic infertility, so we don't know why they're not able to fall pregnant. My go-to ovarian stimulation cycle is a DNRH antagonist or, shorter cycle. There's no right or wrong cycle as a kind of a side message here for anyone. When I worked in the UK, everyone was put through what we call long down regulation cycles, which took 6 to 8 weeks, and nothing was personalized. Whereas what I found and why I like working as a fertility doctor in Australia is I have the freedom to personalize my treatment plans for every single patient. And that's obviously because I work in private practice. And when you work in private practice, and I work with City Fertility, you as a practitioner can personalize it to every single patient that you see. So it's a bit like having a bespoke piece of jewelry or a dress made for you, tailored for you. Mm. And sometimes I know what patients need before they go into an IVF cycle under my care because they've had treatment elsewhere. And if they've had treatment elsewhere, it's important that they share that with me, because then I can see what's worked and what hasn't. And often patients will say to me, I did better on this cycle with this drug. And my ears prick up when I hear that, because I go, okay, well, let's look at what happened. And then often I will be guided by that previous treatment. So sometimes patients get a bit uncomfortable. They feel that if they go and see a new fertility doctor for a second opinion, that they can't get information from the other previous doctor because, oh, the other previous doctor is going to pick up that I'm having fertility treatment elsewhere. And my response to that is, who cares?
Yeah.
Do you seriously think that we are that brokenhearted by this? We accept that patients will do this. It's in your right as a patient.
Mm.
It's my right as a patient to go and see as many doctors as I want about any treatment that I need, you know. And that's very old school to just go under one doctor and accept what that one doctor says. So I would say to couples, particularly women, because I feel women struggle with this more than men, don't feel bad about going to see a couple of doctors for an opinion, even if it's settling on some basic treatment in the initial stages to get a second opinion. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of second opinions.
Yeah. So going back to your question about what does an IVF cycle look like, the average cycle involves, imagine a woman, you know, gets her period, and on the second or third day of her period, she will start injecting herself with daily injections of follicle-stimulating hormone, and we assess her response to that. According to blood tests and ultrasounds, we'll make decisions about when she will have her egg collection. And on average, most women need about 9 or 10 days of that injection cycle. And then about 2 days after you've made a decision for her egg collection, she'll go into the IVF center. And again, doctors do this differently. I always have an anaesthetist present for my egg collections, but I have some colleagues that use Penthrox, this green whistle that they use in the back of ambulances to do their egg collections, you know?
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Yeah. So a lot of doctors do things differently, and you've just got to work with what your doctor offers you. You know, if I have a patient that says to me, I don't want to pay for an anaesthetist, I just want to have this green whistle, I'm like, sure, I can recommend you one of my colleagues who will do this just fine.
Mm.
As a clinician, feel more comfortable with having an anaesthetist.
Mm.
And so on the day of your egg collection, provided we're working with fresh sperm, the male partner will ejaculate in the lab and give us a fresh sperm sample. We then, you know, put the eggs and the sperm together, whether it's with routine injection with ICSI or IVF. We call that insemination. So when you inseminate the eggs, you're putting them together with sperm, whether it's IVF or ICSI. It's the same kind of broad umbrella term, insemination. You inseminate the eggs. Then the next day we get notified about whether those eggs have converted into embryos, have fertilized into embryos, and whether it's normal fertilization. And then generally speaking, we like to put back embryos on the fifth day of development. Sometimes we don't, because the embryos don't get to the fifth day, they disintegrate, or a patient overstimulates and we are concerned about their health primarily, because it's safety first. So we don't put back an embryo fresh, we put back an embryo frozen.
Mm-hmm.
But say you have the typical cycle where a woman has an embryo put back, best embryo put back fresh. She gets pregnant, hurrah, that's like the best outcome. And then she's got a couple of embryos that are suitable for freezing. Or they may be suitable not just for freezing, but for embryo biopsy that we talked about before, PGS, to look for abnormalities.
Yes.
So the ultimate cycle is when a woman can achieve her desired outcome, that is 1, 2, 3, 4 kids from one IVF cycle. That is the ultimate outcome. However, most women on average will need about, well, not just women, couples. Mm-hmm. But I say women because I see a lot of women who are single who are having this done on their own. But couples, women, whatever, they will achieve this outcome in 3 or 4 cycles. So I say to them, you may need 3 or 4 cycles to get to your outcome. If you're lucky, it'll happen the first time, and I wish that for you, but it doesn't happen for everyone.
Mm.
Now, there are different protocols that we use. So there is an injection called a Lonva, which is one injection that covers you for 7 days worth of that FSH injection. If you're hypothalamic, so if you're a crazy CrossFitter, for example, and you will not give up your CrossFit for anything, including IVF, and you have really low LH levels, so your hypothalamus is suppressed, and that's why you're not getting regular periods, and that's why you're coming to see me, then I would need to give you some form of luteinizing hormone. So that's the basic premise of an IVF cycle. Depending on where you live in the world, it may be different. In Australia, though, the antagonist cycle, the short TER cycle, has become probably the most common type of cycle because it's the safest cycle for the patients. They're less likely to get ovarian hyperstimulation, and they're more likely to stick to it for future pregnancy or for future rounds, because it doesn't take 6 to 8 weeks out of their life. It might take up to 3 or 4 weeks at most.
Mm. And do you recommend that people do IVF cycles back to back, or that they have breaks in between? What's your guidance around that?
I leave it up to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Completely. There are some instances where you know the patient should have a rest. So if she has really overstimulated and her ovaries have blown up big time, she's had a lot of discomfort and pain, or she's developed OHSS, ended up in hospital, she's going to have a break for a couple of months. Psychologically, people need to have a break sometimes. It's not just a physical thing. They psychologically need a break. Mm-hmm. So I always leave it up to the patient. They discuss it with their partners and they make a decision about that. It's the same with egg freezing. I say to women, see how you feel. Do one cycle, see how you feel. If you feel like jumping into another cycle straight away, do it. If you feel like having a break, have a break. You don't sign on a dotted line anywhere that says, I must commit to 3 cycles in a row, August, September, October, 2020. Mm. No, that doesn't exist.
Mm. Gotcha. Well, that's good to know. Good to know. And in terms of myths, misconceptions, what do you feel like are some of the most common ones that either we maybe haven't mentioned already when it comes to IVF that you're having to constantly re-educate on?
Mm. So the AMH that we talked about earlier, so if a woman has a low AMH, please don't get stressed out about the fact that you feel that it means that you're not ever going to get pregnant ever. Just think about the patient that I talked about earlier with the multiple terminations and now who has 2 children. Mm-hmm. So AMH comes up a lot. The other one would be that, you know, IVF is not guaranteed. It's not the be all and end all. And just because you do IVF doesn't mean you can't do simpler options later. So you can go to IVF straight away and then go, you know, this isn't for me or it's not working. Let's do something more simple. Mm-hmm. IVF is not just the end of the line. And to look at other ways of parenting, whether it be fostering, adopting, and really going deep with counseling about what would it look like not being a genetic parent to some child.
Mm.
What's that going to mean to you and your partner? And going really deep with a counsellor who you connect with about that, and to work on that from the outset, that's, I feel, very important.
Yeah.
If you are going to look at embryo biopsy, for example, if I am having recurrent pregnancy loss and I really want embryo biopsy, but you may not get to that embryo biopsy, and that we may need to end up putting back an embryo that's been untested in you. And if you were to get pregnant, there are tests that you can do in pregnancy. However, mm-hmm. if you did get pregnant would you be open to having testing in pregnancy, and would you be open to having abortion, a medical abortion for, say, a trisomy or a Down syndrome? So they're the misconceptions, I feel, that I come up with a lot.
Yeah. I have a quick question on just something that I feel like is probably going to come up if I don't ask it, which is in terms of like when you're speaking about some embryos being able to be tested and some aren't, is one that can't be tested more likely to be a problematic one than one that can be tested? Or is it just a matter of some of them can be tested from passing the lab test and some just can't?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it's just that some embryos are meeting that criteria earlier than others, but that embryo that meets criteria earlier than others may still be abnormal compared to the slower embryo. So, and I've asked this many times to scientists, and the great thing about science is it changes all the time. And if you're like me, and I think you're a bit like this, Natalie, you know, you like to kind of be challenged all the time in terms of academics and keeping up to date with the latest. And always asking, if you're going through fertility treatment, asking the scientists, what's the latest on this? And I've always asked, are boy embryos quicker or slower than girl embryos? You know, if you're looking at a bunch of embryos, some are suitable for testing and some are not, are the more suitable boys or are they girls? And I've never really gotten a straight answer from a scientist about that one.
Yeah, I was about to ask you what's the answer. Oh, that's good. And yeah, you're right. I love asking questions. And actually, Tash, that's something I really love about you is I always know that when I'm referring patients to you and even just asking you questions myself, that you just have such a good curiosity, not just in your field. I feel like you are just a curious person and always asking questions and not afraid to be asking questions, which I feel like is such a good, like a really good sign of a good practitioner, because the reality is we don't know it all. Like even those of us working in like a specialty area, I don't know everything about thyroid health. But I think sometimes the assumption is that I do. And likewise, you probably have people say like assuming that you know absolutely everything about fertility, and it's, you know, I wish I did, but I don't. And I think remaining curious is so important to being a good practitioner.
Oh yeah. I mean, I open up Google a lot of the time in front of my patients and ask them, what the hell is that? What medication are you on? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
and my mantra is questions are life. You know, questions are life. And a few weeks ago I had a patient come to see me for a gynecological reason. She's menopausal, but she has a very rare condition called porphyria, which is a very rare genetic condition. And I've only ever read about this condition in textbooks. I've never actually seen a patient with this condition in my life. And I said to her, you know, I've never seen a patient with this. You're the first woman I've ever seen with this condition. And it was interesting to me because her flare-ups, her crises relied on her menstrual cycle. And I thought, wow, I didn't even know how progesterone and estrogen affect you. But the beauty about this patient was that she had printed off an article about her condition and gave it to me. And I'm like, oh, I love this. And it was such a great consult because, you know, I just got a lot of joy from being taught by her. But I think she also appreciated the fact that I was open about the fact that I didn't know anything about her condition yet. I'd be open to learning more about it.
Oh, gosh, like you've totally hit the nail on the head, because I think that a lot of patients that I work with feel very dismissed by doctors and specialists. And obviously that's a generalization and I'm only speaking from my own experience, but I can't tell you how appreciated it is and actually how rare you are, Tash, where you love being like given new information instead of getting defensive about it. And I actually tell my patients often, you don't necessarily have to see the like smartest person in the world about, you know, in the area that you're interested in, but I do encourage you to see someone that you feel heard by and who's open-minded, because I think the most dangerous thing is a practitioner that is, you know, thinks they know everything or isn't willing to learn or say, I don't know, or ask questions. And I like love that about you. So thanks for being that person.
Thank you. Yeah. It's questions are life. So I just encourage everyone to ask questions.
Love it.
And what I love is when people say, I know this is a really silly question. And of course, who is it that says that, who prefaces their questions like that? It's women. Right. Don't apologize for having a question.
Yes. I need to pick myself up on that because I definitely do that sometimes, especially when I'm asking questions of people who I feel are smarter than me or know more than I do. So great point. Going to work on that one myself.
Yeah.
So speaking of working with you, where are you currently practicing and where can people find out more about you?
So I'm based in the Inner West. I'm in Newtown, so I have rooms in the RPA Medical Center. I do all my fertility treatment through City Fertility, which is based at the Gateway Building, this gorgeous, gorgeous building that faces the harbour. So patients will have an IVF procedure and will wake up looking at the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House. So I'm very excited by this recent move of mine. Mm. And they are very supportive of my podcast, which is The Fanny Mechanic. And they, you know, what I love about this group is that they had faith in me when I moved across to them. I don't need to run anything through them about what my podcasts are about. They don't need to know. They just said, just don't worry, we'll support you because we believe in you. And I've been very grateful to have moved across to them this year. And, if you wanted to hear more about the Fanny Mechanic, you can pop over to Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts on, the Fanny Mechanic. And I need to get you on there, Natalie, I swear,
about
thyroid. And, I've got a book club that I run once a month in Newtown called the Dr. Tash Book Club. We often have authors coming across who talk about their book, and I'm really excited because next week we're talking about Gabrielle Jackson's book, the book about pain and prejudice, which is about women and how we are prejudiced in society on many levels, like in terms of how we're treated in regards to our pain. Mm. And I'm hoping that she'll come along to that. And Instagram, I'm Dr. Tash Fanny Mechanic. And on Facebook, I'm Dr. Tash.
I will make sure all the links are in the show notes for anyone frantically writing that down. And love that you have a book.
And I dabbled in YouTube a few years ago, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I've made some YouTube videos. I had one patient come and see me and she said, you know why I came to see you? And I said, why? She goes, because you made a video about broccoli.
Oh, sometimes we forget what we've put out there, don't we?
Yeah, and I'm like, oh my God, I forgot that video, but I remember having a really good time making that video with my friend.
Yeah, that's so good. So good. And last question for you is, what's one thing that you do for your health every day to really allow you to show up in your life in the way that you want to?
Sleep. So I make sure I get good sleep pretty much. So my routine at night, you know, you asked me about my routine in the morning. Yeah. My routine at night is very important to me. So when I get home, I don't watch TV. So I don't ever watch TV. It's just not my thing. It's too much stimulation for me. I read a book. I have quiet in the evenings. I live alone. So I have the luxury of choosing quiet when I come home. Because it's not always that easy to get quiet if you've got lots of kids running around, whatever. I relish my evenings and I essential oils are a big part of my winding down. Mm. So lavender oil, lang lang, frankincense. I read a book that I ask myself, what am I in the mood for tonight? And I may pick up some poetry or a current book that I'm reading for my book club. Again, I ask myself, what do I want? Mm. What do I feel like doing now? Because nobody's putting pressure on me. It's just me putting pressure on myself, right? Yeah. So, and then I make sure I get at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night. And I may make myself like a hot cup of warm milk, whether it's, you know, lactose free, oat, whatever, almond, but usually light milk with some lavender sprinkled in, like the, you know, that culinary lavender.
Oh, yeah.
And some honey. and I usually sleep really well. So I wake up feeling my energy levels are super high in the morning. So I feel it's because I sleep very well, and I make that my priority.
I love that. I think more people should make sleep their priority. It's game changer.
Yeah, it totally is. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and your brain and your heart and your wisdom with us today. And I definitely will encourage everyone to go and check out your podcast. There are some really good episodes there, and I'm really enjoying listening to them, making my way through them as well. So thanks, Tash, and I will speak to you soon.
Thanks, Natalie.